Welcome back to Fanacek. This is a very, very exciting episode. I'm excited about my guest, but before I even talk about that, if you enjoyed that music that came on before my normal intro and didn't know what it was, that is the score to the 80s classic, The Beastmaster. And that'll be coming up later during my conversation with my guest, the Reverend Scott K. Now, the Rev is one of my favorite people. He's got several different podcasts. He's got a podcast called The Cheeky Bastards, where him and his partner talk about action movies. He's got one called Dropping a Bruce, and this is great. It's pretty niche. They talk about the 40 direct-to-DVD or direct-to-video movies that Bruce Willis has made throughout his career. But what he does that I love the most and what introduced me to the Rev was The Church of Tarantino. Now, he's got this great podcast called The Church of Tarantino devoted to, I'm guessing you understand this, Quentin Tarantino. This season in particular is the 30th anniversary of Pulp Fiction. So the whole season's been devoted around that. And within Church of Tarantino, he's got different series. He's got Pulp Reflections, where it's like retrospective looks back at Pulp Fiction. Inglourious Blue Balls, where they talk about projects that Quentin Tarantino has talked about doing or has promised to do and never did, leaving us with those proverbial blue balls. He's got character studies where we're going back and we're talking about different characters from Pulp Fiction. And then in previous episodes, he dives into all the movies. So if you love Quentin Tarantino, it's arguably the best Quentin Tarantino podcast out there, The Church of Tarantino. I have been a guest 3 times on The Church of Tarantino. One of them, as I've recorded this, one of them is aired a couple months ago, or actually might have been last year. And then I've got a couple more coming out later this year, but I hope you enjoy this conversation with the Reverend Scott from The Church of Tarantino. I've got the Reverend Scott K from The Church of Tarantino on Fanacek. Thank you, sir. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me. You've been on mine quite a little bit, so it's only right for the Reverend to come out and make a house call.
I appreciate that, man. Yeah, I've had the honor of being on your show 3 times now, 2 of which haven't come out yet. You're one of those planning podcasters. I'm more of a fly by the seat of his pants podcaster.
Well, you're smart because you do 1 show that I know of. I have 3 series on my own show, and then I do an entire 2 other episodes or shows for my Cheeky Bastard side projects I do. So I do 5 shows that come out a month.
Wow.
It's insanity. It's insane. Yeah. So especially coming into this year, knowing that, you know, as you know, and now your listeners will know, but as we're covering only Pulp Fiction for the 30th anniversary. So I've got a bunch, to be able to make sure I got all this stuff going on. And plus I do anniversary episodes for every movie that in the Tarantino verse that, has an anniversary. And this year, of course, there are 4 of them.
Yeah.
Kill Bill Volume 2 is 20. Both Natural Born Killers and Pulp Fiction turn 30. And then of course the Inglourious Basterds turns 15. The movie you love, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, does turn 5, but I feel you got to get to 10. I feel like 10's the magic number to get an anniversary episode,
That's fair.
Five's good for a kid for a birthday, right? Like you're 5, you're going to be a kindergartner. That's great, but not for a movie. You know, 10 years is like, oh my God. We usually go, oh my God, 10 years have gotten by. Not like, oh, 5 years have gotten by. So
now, 10's when you get the special edition Blu-ray and
yeah, exactly.
You have to 10 years for that. Yeah.
Yeah, no one's buying the 5th anniversary Blu-ray. They're like, fuck you. I just got the other one.
Let's talk about your podcast. So, I'm a big fan of Church of Tarantino, but I know that wasn't your first podcast. So what led you to this?
It wasn't. The oddest thing ever is I decided I wanted to do a podcast right before COVID happened. Did not know COVID was coming. Like the rest of the world didn't know. So probably January, February of 2020. A buddy of mine, when I worked at the Apple store here in Syracuse, New York, we wanted to do a podcast together. And I always thought I would do a Tarantino, but I thought at the time, did no research. So back then you could see how new I was, but I thought everyone's doing a Tarantino podcast. So I said, you know what? Let's do one of my favorite actors, Nicolas Cage. Well, lo and behold, Nicolas Cage has got like 1,000 people doing podcasts for him. So we started with the Nicolas Cage one about 2 weeks before COVID hit, and then COVID hits. And so then it gets weird, right? But it's easier to record because back then, before 2020, anyone who's just started podcasting, it felt like you had to have your own studio to record. Like everyone had their own studios they went to, right? They didn't even do it at home. But 2020 happened, and then pretty soon everyone was like, oh, I really can do this at home. This is so much easier. Like places like Anchor, which is where I started, and now it's Spotify owns them. But that was where I first started, putting my podcast up on. So that lasted 6 months, and we bit off way more than we could chew. We tried to do 2 movies a week It got it. We know. I think we got through six months, but it killed us. So we shifted to a podcast called Watch This or Die, which was more of, again, we went through all the movies we loved, and each week we'd recommend it, and we'd give you five reasons why you should watch it, right? So we'd give you the five main reasons we think you should watch this film. Not just like, hey, we like this film, but we tried to break it down. With movie review podcasts, they're like a dime a dozen, so you have to try to find something that breaks through.
Sure.
We did over a year of that, and we were in our second season, and my former co-host was about to have a second child, and so his time was pretty much null and void at that moment. So we had to kind of like end the podcast. So that November of 2021, I was like, what am I going to do? Because I wanted to keep going, but I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And so I was like, you know what? I'd love to do Tarantino, but let me at least research. What kind of noise do I have to try to fight through? If there was even like 5 or 10 of them, I was like, no, they're already well ahead. There's nothing I can bring to that conversation that hasn't been brought. Well, lo and behold, no one was doing a podcast on him. He hadn't even launched his own podcast yet. No one was doing a podcast yet. He had been on episodes of people's, and there had been a couple of like podcasts that maybe had done like either a couple of episodes based on him, you know, like they did the 9 films at the time.
Sure.
But no one was doing Tarantino on a regular basis. And all they ever really did was they just kind of talked about those films. So I saw this as lightning in a bottle. This is the perfect moment for me. I was like, this is the one I'm going to do. And so I chose the name. I'm not sure if that was a question I asked next, but I chose the name because on the special features for Pulp Fiction, they do this retrospective. They have like a thing with Siskel and Ebert talk about how amazing Pulp Fiction, like their first, up back to the balcony thing they used to do. And they had the real thing, but they went through this thing about how that when this movie came out, when Pulp Fiction came out, it was just the dawn of the internet. And so chat rooms were a big thing back then, and so the Church of Tarantino was the first chat room dedicated to talking about Tarantino's film on the internet. That has since, I think, changed into the Tarantino Archives, and it's not a chat room anymore. Because when I put in the Church of Tarantino, I got like kind of sent to the Tarantino Archives. So there's nothing out there. So I said, in Tarantino spirit, you pay homage to what came before you. And so I took the Church of Tarantino as the podcast name, as since that was the first place to talk about, I now feel like maybe I'm wrong, but I think I'm the only podcast that's ever focused this long on the man himself.
Sure.
So I felt it was the right name to take. And so that's how I got to this. And then it wasn't good enough, right? I just couldn't stay there. But I have a side project called The Cheeky Bastards with my buddy Steve. And Steve was like one of the only listeners who would reach out to us on the Watch Us or Die. Like he would send us things like, he'd be like, because we'd say, what movie we're talking about that week. And he would be, make some funny jokes. Like, are you guys like literally stealing from my collection? Like we'd go back and forth. And he was going to be the first guest I wanted to bring on our show, but never got a chance to. Uh-huh. So when I was looking for my first guest for the first episode, I said, I think Steve's the guy. Because we already had kind of a little bit of rapport. So like, let's bring him on. And he was such a great guest and really filled in a lot in that first season and helped me out when like people could drop out or whatever, that we got such a good rapport that we actually started that podcast together, I think 9 months into my first year of the Church of Tarantino. And then we've added on to doing all the Bruce Willis's stuff. Like, I don't know why I do this, but I love doing it.
Yeah.
But I always, I don't know what's wrong with me. But I don't know why. I'm doing 1 week. Now I'm going 5 in a month.
Wow.
This season, it's just insanity.
Yeah, yeah. What's the Bruce Willis dropping a Bruce, right? Is that?
It's called Dropping a Bruce. And we look at the 40 direct-to-DVD video release films he did in his career. And they are slogged, I'll tell you that. But that was originally the Cheeky Bastards was born after that. Because literally, we talked about doing that. And 2 weeks after we said we're going to do that and get ready to start on it, the aphasia release came out. He had that. So we waited. We put that on the side for a year. So we started the Cheeky Bastards. We got into the Cheeky Bastards. 6 months into that, so it would be about a year after we talked about it, we went back to the Bruce one because we figured there's enough time. And then people wouldn't think that we're just being total assholes.
Right.
Because how do you go and talk about films like that of his, but now having done it since, it makes a lot of sense with the movies we watch. Like you can now see why he was doing them, some of why the performances weren't good. Like you can see some of the aphasia actually rear its ugly head in some of his performances in some of the films, not all of them, but we're still early on. We still got another 26 to go, but yeah. So
So I, you know, having talked to you several times now, I know that you initially had an end game for Church of Terrence. You know, you first got screwed by the strike, and now, as you know, I was going to ask about this. Tarantino decides to scrap the movie critic. What the hell is going on?
So anyone who doesn't listen to my show, I'm not a Tarantino dick sucker, as I might say. I don't just drop down and take everything he says. You know, when I feel he has some explaining to do, I will grill it. And so I was chafed by him a year ago when he announced that there was something in the movie, because I'm still 100% almost positive that in some way or form the movie critic was originally the TV show he announced.
Right.
He does not make movies in 4 months. He doesn't suddenly come up with an idea in 4 months. He had no plans for any of it. Now, I think now that this has been released, that he's canceled it, there is some talk about how he was at an Adobe Max event in 2016 and mentioned something about possibly doing a movie about a critic kind of thing. But that's also before Once Upon a Time in Hollywood comes out. So I wonder how much of that had morphed. I feel that that was his TV show. I feel that he chiseled that down like he did eventually in Inglourious Basterds. A great interview, if you ever get a chance, on the Elway Network, you can get on YouTube between, it's called the Director Series, and it's Rodriguez interviews directors, and he interviewed, had like a two-part interview with Tarantino, and they kind of go through Inglourious Basterds, and he talks about he originally wrote it as a miniseries, and it was actually Luc Besson who made him change his mind, because he told him that he only gets up to go to the theater to go see his movies. And he was like, so now you're telling me I had to wait another 6 fucking years for you to put another movie out there? And so he went back and he found it, because he just thought it was a miniseries. He didn't know he could make it short and make it work. And he didn't. Obviously, now we know how that turns out, because Inglourious Basterds was born from that.
Sure.
So I thought that my podcast would go 5 years. That year 5, like at the end of this coming year, at Christmas time of next year, at the end of season 4, the movie critic would come out. I would spend season 5 talking only about the movie critic, and then also parlaying it into a discussion about his now totality of a film career, right? Like what's his stance going to be? Is he going to be up there? You know, is he in the same breath as the greats that people, you know, will count as the greats? Is he the greatest? That kind of debate, we could talk about his legacy.
Yeah.
Now that he's pulled the plug on this and we got 2-3 more years possibly before he has something come out, I don't know what I'm gonna do. I've got some ideas. I've already got some ideas for season 4. I don't know. We'll see. I'm pulling back a bit. There will not be as many episodes next year. We'll go back to the standard 2 a month.
Yeah.
You know, because I had, as you know, I have a Tarantino speculation series, but now that there's nothing to speculate on, it'll probably fizzle out at the end of this year, and we'll spy, you know, bypass that till something else happens. But
you may have to end it and just do like a reboot, you know.
I thought about that. I may have to make Michael Jordan take a couple years off, go play baseball, and then come back, you know.
Yeah. Because if he doesn't do the movie critic, it could be upwards of 8-9 years before we get another movie.
I mean, there's a real chance. I think this is going to be as long as, because it was 6 years between Jackie Brown and Kill Bill.
Yeah.
And so we are obviously 5 years. So it would have been 6 years when it came out. A little over, because it came out in July. So it would have been a little over 6 years. Probably still the longest. But now, unless, of course, he's got another one he can do in 4 months, as everyone thinks he can, which is not true. We're at least 2-3 years away again. So you're looking at 9-10 years between. So we're looking almost 2030. I mean, I know that sounds crazy, but 20 somewhere in that time frame, 2028 and 2030 time frame before we see another Tarantino project and maybe the final.
And there were a lot of rumors about this. So I was excited for the movie critic because it, you know, again, like as you mentioned, my favorite Tarantino movie is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So I felt like we were staying in that world of Hollywood. I think it was 1977, but the rumors had spiraled. So, you know, Brad Pitt was confirmed, I guess. Yep. But this whole Cliff Booth thing and making it central, I wasn't a fan of that. And
that thing I think came because of the strikes. I think because of the strikes. I think he was. Oh, I think Cliff Booth was going to make. Originally, my feeling was Cliff Booth was going to just make a cameo.
Agreed.
Kind of like, you know, anyone. I mean, we're deep diving into the Tarantino world. And I apologize, since your podcast isn't technically on Tarantino.
No. I do apologize. I did a whole season on Once Upon a Time.
This is true. You did.
Yeah.
But if anyone saw Jackie Brown, Michael Keaton's character. I mean, it's a character from an Elmore Leonard novel, anyways. But he reprised the role as himself in Out of Sight. But he reappears in a brief moment in that movie,
right?
And which was awesome. Like, it was such a cool thing to see, you know, especially, you know, people in the audience who hadn't seen Jackie Brown, Oh, they were like, oh, wow, Michael Keaton cameoed in this. But people who had seen Jackie Brown were like, oh, that's fucking cool. Because right. It is Elmer Leonard's world, not sure. Tarantino's world. But it was awesome to see that. So I thought we were going to get a Cliff Booth and a Rick Dalton cameo for whatever. Like maybe we just show one of their moves. Like they'd be in it for a small scene. You know, right. I really did feel like that was probably a possibility.
Which is what I was hoping for, cameos. Yeah.
But it would be focused on someone else, like this almost deranged or slowly getting deranged movie critic. Like,
right.
I feel like someone, I mean, you can't say the guy is going to be a cross between Howard Stern and Travis Bickle and us not start thinking something's going off the tracks, right? Like somehow he's going to get a little bit demented, almost a la, I forget the gentleman's name who shot Ronald Reagan because he was trying to impress
Jodie Foster.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That kind of thing. Like the guy loses a little bit and he goes and maybe tries to kill like a producer, something along that line, right? Because that would be the Travis Bickle. I mean, what else would, you know, how else could a Travis Bickle be in a film, you know what I mean? Or a guy be like Travis Bickle and not be like Travis Bickle?
No, it can't end well. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
But like you, I'm glad it didn't happen now because I don't want a sequel. We already have the sequel. If you want a sequel to Once Upon a Time, read the book. That's the sequel.
Yep.
That is the sequel.
And in video archives, they did the two episode memoriam when Rick Dalton died.
We're recording in May. He died a year ago now. So.
That's right. That's right.
The fictional character of Rick Dalton's been dead a year. May he fictionally rest in peace.
Yeah, I feel like he gave us enough Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And if I'm Brad Pitt, I don't do it either. Like that's likely the only Oscar he's going to get. Why go back and play that role again? I don't know. I mean, I wanted
how does he play it better? Because now, as you've probably heard, he moves on and he does have a bit of, because we did the movie together on my Under the Influence, but he does have a bit of the bandit type of career now. Like, so now he kind of has Rick Dalton plays his Burt Reynolds character and helps him kind of become a director. We're really kind of going down that route. And now the coolness of who his character was is not as cool because when you read the book and you see him in the movie, like there's a lore to him. We don't want to see him defanged, right? Like the coolest thing he just did was save his buddy's wife and him. And he said it was a good friend. He took a knife to the leg for his friend and almost died. Right. Yep. How does him becoming a director make it cooler?
Yeah.
And it just doesn't maybe John Q Public would enjoy it. Cause if they're just a general movie fan, they might enjoy the performance and be cool with it. Like, you know, that's what we find. But the hardened Tarantino fans, or especially if you're a Once Upon a Time in Hollywood fan, you're not going to enjoy that. You're going to be like, no, that's not the Rick Dalton I know. And I don't want to see, or not Rick Dalton, sorry. That's not the Cliff Booth I know. And I don't want to see Cliff defanged.
No, you know? Not at all.
And maybe the other thing he ran into was figuring out, okay, now how do I make a movie that's a sequel that doesn't require people to have read the book? How does that happen? Now he's got to start bringing things from the book to life. You know what I mean? It can't be a prequel because some people weren't sure if it's a prequel or sequel. It can't be a prequel because technically the prequel is also the book. You know what I mean? Like we learned a lot. There's a lot of, because the book is written nonlinear, as all books, a lot of fiction are. And so we do flashbacks to how Rick or how Cliff gets the places and how he gets the dog and what truly happens on that boat and all these things that happen before the events of the film. And how do we, you know, like then you ruin another piece of literature too. So I don't think it makes it better, which is why when now people are clamoring for Kill Bill Volume 3, I think leaving Kill Bill Volume 3 alone is the right move. I think if you're ever going to do that, you just do it as an anime or something. Then you can do the voice actors if you want. But I don't see how finishing a story that does have an ending to it, we need to have. You know, I don't see how he can write a better epic than Kill Bill.
No, I'm with you.
To make it better. You know, like it just, I don't know. You know, I don't think he's going to go that route either. But I don't think he's in the sequel game. And I know some people are like, well, Kill Bill Volume 2 sequel. No. It's not a sequel. It was never a sequel. It was written as one. It was broken up because of the wine scenes. So it became two volumes, but it is one film. And it just happens to be great editing and great writing. The fact that the split happens at the right spot where the Eastern and the Western film kind of actually separate at that moment. But it was going to happen that way in the film anyways.
Correct.
And maybe it would have been more jarring as the whole Bloody Affair. If you think about the movie going public, who couldn't handle talking or, you know, watching Grindhouse and didn't understand what was going on there. And some people are still blown away that John Travolta comes back at the end of Pulp Fiction. You know, they can't wrap their mind around how that happened.
I thought he was dead.
What about he was dead? It's like, no, well, man, He did bookend this for you. When he and that black gentleman showed back up at the other part of the film, did you not know you're back in the future?
Right.
Did we need Doc to show up and it's in the DeLorean to bring us back?
That would be great. I'd like that crossover. I don't know. Yeah. But so I mean, he's talked about all these things he wants to do, stage versions of things, more novelizations of his movies. Obviously, there's a bounty law, you know, that's been talked about doing Netflix and bounty law. What do you think is going to be next? Any guesses? Or does he come out? Is he just writing a movie? Or?
I think it's a brand new movie. Wow. I do. It's crazy. It's surprising that it took me almost 3 to 4. Oh, actually, I think it's 5 or 6 years since he recorded this. But the fact that I had not seen his interview with Robert Rodriguez before. So I recently watched it this past week because, you know, I've been using clips of it in my show. And I finally sat down and watched the whole thing. And Rodriguez was walking around. He made a comment about how when he walks around his house, he goes, I see bits and pieces of paper where you have these amazing ideas that I can make a three movie picture out of. And you just throw them away. So there's probably tons of ideas he's written and just didn't do. I'm not saying he's going to go back to him, but I don't think he's short on them. I think what he did is he lived too long in Once Upon a Time. He did this. He wrote a book. Yeah. He kills off the character. Like, and I don't begrudge him falling in love with a moment in time and enjoying it, because I think it was a nostalgia thing too. It was his childhood he got to bring back to life a little bit, kind of. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And
no, absolutely.
He got to live his childhood through his adult eyes, right? Like, he got to do that kind of thing. And but I think he stayed too long on memory lane, as they say.
Yeah.
You know, that my mom says, you can visit memory lane, but you can't live there. And I think he started to live there. And then he started to try to shoehorn in a sequel when it wasn't originally going to be a sequel. And I think he just got himself, along with putting the pressure on himself for saying that he was going to be done at 10 films. I may have said it to you, but it's been on my show before I've said it. He should never have said that. He should have made his 10th film. And when the credits come up, because he always says usually says this number film by Quentin Tarantino. I think he's actually stopped doing that recently. But it should have said the 10th and final film by Quentin Tarantino. Everyone in the audience would have been like, what? You drop it on him like he does a lot of things, like the Gimp, like just drop it on us like you do a lot of things.
Sure.
And we all would have been like, whoa, he would have had so much more freedom and not been like, I feel he's backed himself into a corner. He's put himself in that corner.
He really has.
And now he's feeling the stress for the first time since Death Proof. The last time he felt unsure of himself was because Death Proof didn't succeed. And in that interview, he even talks about how he and Robert were feeling, you know, king of the world. He just come off Kill Bill, and Robert had just come off Sin City. Arguably two of their best films apiece. Sin City is Robert Rodriguez's best film. That's a hands-down thing. What he did with Sin City is unbelievable. There's no graphic novel movie better than Sin City. That is he made the greatest graphic novel, you know, bringing a graphic novel to life in a movie ever. And Sin City is an amazing film.
Sure it is. Yeah.
And Kill Bill speaks for itself. So they did this movie together, and they were cocky. They thought people were going to love it, and then wasn't successful. And so Tarantino was really stunned. And it's also why he had his shortest turnaround, is because he wanted to get back on the horse and prove that he had to bring his confidence back. And so he creates Inglourious Basterds.
Sure.
So I feel this is another one of those Death Proof punch in the face. So I feel he's going to get back on the horse, and we're going to get a Kill Bill and Inglourious Basterds, because there's two lulls of films that people consider: Jackie Brown and Death Proof. The following films have been Kill Bill and Inglourious Basterds. So I think we're in for what it's going to be. Who fucking knows? I've heard people are really clamoring for like a horror film, because he's never really done. I know he did Death Proof, but like really steep into horror.
Sure.
Because he's a big giallo film.
He loves giallo.
And some people would like to see him do sci-fi. I think when he was going to do Star Trek, he was going to do sci-fi, but it was going to be not the sci-fi people think. And I've also read an article, and I kind of agree with a guy who wrote one recently. Go back to your crime days. Some of his best films are his early films.
Sure.
The crime world is what he knows. After Jackie Brown, he got into making films of genres he loved watching as a kid. So he kind of like put his own hat in the ring in those genres. But the crime genre was always his.
Oh, sure. I mean,
his thing. So, I mean, I think people would love another crime movie from him. He could also then scale down his cast. He could cast people that no one would expect, because when you look back at them, the casts are now impressive, but Reservoir Dogs cast back when we knew it, Harvey Keitel was the biggest name, and he wasn't the biggest name. You know what I mean? Like, he's a big name, and he's a big name, but he's not, you know, he's not Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci, you know, he's not Al Pacino. He's not those guys, but he's still a good get. John Travolta was a name. Bruce Willis was the biggest name for Pulp Fiction when that movie came out. John Travolta was just getting brought back to life.
Absolutely.
Jackie Brown, Samuel Jackson, oddly enough, was the biggest name for that film because no one knew who Robert Foster was or Forster, and no one knew Pam Grier was unless you knew exploitation movies.
That's the truth, yeah.
So those first three films, and even Uma Thurman, if we're honest, too,
she really
made her bones in Kill Bill. So, like, he brings people to become stars. So I say go back to that. Go back to
doing that.
Don't get me wrong. Having Leonardo and getting Brad Pitt together in the film, you got that because you proved your skills, right? Like even Leo was a bit part, but he was a supporting actor in Django, and we don't see him for almost an hour and a half.
Yeah, it's true.
You know what I mean? So like there are some great opportunities. Inglourious Basterds, keep going there. Inglourious Basterds, Hans Landa.
Yeah.
You know, man. Christoph Waltz, we didn't know who the fuck he was.
No clue who that guy was.
And when he's on screen, you're like, oh, you know, like if you they have a movie where suddenly you go, Christoph Waltz and Samuel Jackson, and you go, this is gold. Like we already know, like it's sold out open night. Like we know, they're like this is gold. Those two guys make love to his dialogue.
Oh, sure.
Right? Like I could listen to two of them just having a conversation about the validity of air conditioning, whatever. And I would just be like, I'd be enthralled. They'd make it scary, you know what I mean? And the coolest conversation you'd ever heard in your life. So maybe he just dials it back and goes back to just, you know, doing something that was in his wheelhouse.
Horror is a good suggestion. He loves, like we said, he loves giallo films. He's a big Brian De Palma guy. He always talks about De Palma. Even when he talks about Travolta, he's always talking about Blowout as being Travolta's best thing. And that's a small cast, scaled down cast. I could see that. Like, he's really shooting himself in the foot, though, too, because this shifting gears really flies in the face of his whole rationale about stopping directing films anyway, because his whole thing is directors get better as they get older. It's like, dude, you're stacking years onto this now, man. You know?
I know. I mean, as I said in my most recent Inglourious Blue Balls series, where we actually couldn't believe I was doing for my fourth episode, was the movie. Yep. That was quite a surprise. And we got it together quickly because it happened 9 days before the episode of Constable. We were able to record quick. But as I said in there, he is the one who his big mouth has put this albatross around his neck. He has put himself into this position.
Yeah.
No one else but him.
Totally.
You know, it's funny. His own hubris and worrying about something that's probably not important about how you know, with age, and maybe let us decide as the fans. But now I think he has put himself into this almost writer's block. But I do think he feels that confidence lacking. So all I'm saying is the last time it happened, he came back with Inglourious Basterds, and he did, you know, so he did it in a 2-year time frame. Like he literally sat down and did it. So maybe there's something he's always wanted to polish up, and you know, and he's like, you know what, I'm going to make this movie work, and he makes it work. And the next thing we know, we've got something, and we're like, holy shit, that was amazing.
Yeah.
I do believe we'll look back in hindsight and be like, you know what? The movie we got was the movie we deserved, you know, as opposed to being I wonder what the movie could have been like, you know?
Yeah. But I will say this, though, because I know you said he spent a lot of time in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you know, and living in that world. For someone, though, where that's their favorite movie, boy, did I get a lot, because I got the movie, then I got the novelization, then I got, you know, Rick Dalton being made real almost via Video Archives podcast. I think I'm going to get a stage production of it at some point. And the one thing I'm hoping for, almost as much as a new Tarantino movie, is this extended cut that we keep hearing about, like this 4+ hour version of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, because they filmed at J.C. Breen's house. There's all kinds of sequence. Tim Roth was in it as a butler, which we never saw. So anyway, but I will say, you're probably right. He spent too much time there, but boy, did I get a lot for my money. I got to live in this world, you know?
I will give you a word of caution. As a Kill Bill fan, I'm still waiting on the whole bloody affair that was promised since 2006, and we are in 2024. So that promise is old enough to fucking vote now. So just beware that you may have less hair and more gray by the time that ever happens. And he just suddenly dropped that giant out of the blue, all of a sudden on Netflix, like one day, it's like, hey, watch The Hateful Eight Extended. And you're like, and it's broken into like four episodes. You're like, wait a minute, what? When was this coming? Like, that's who he is as a person sometimes. You're like, wait a minute, there's an extended of this, but where's the other things we were promised? Where are those?
Yeah, I know. He doesn't always deliver what he promises. He delivers, but not always what he promises.
Hence why I have a new series devoted solely to that.
So let's talk a little bit about Mr. Tarantino. You know, yes. One of the things I want to talk to you about is things he's turned us on to, like things that we're fans of now or that we're interested in now that we wouldn't have been without his work, whether it be his films, his book, Cinema Speculation, the Video Archives podcast. Because we've talked about this before on your show, although it's not come out yet as we're recording this. One of the conversations I had with you last on Church of Tarantino, we talked about what a steward he is for everything that came before him, for all these genres, directors, film processes, whatever it may be. He's a steward of these things. And now because of that, he's kind of making us stewards of these things. There's certain things now that I hold sacred that I would never have been turned on to for him. So I thought I'd let you start. What's something that he's turned you on to, or an actor or a movie or a style? Well, you name it. I don't care.
I think one of the biggest things he turned me on to, this is mid to late 90s, is when he started to really talk about, everyone started to learn about that. One of his favorite directors was John Woo, and John Woo's Hong Kong films, not his American films, obviously, back in Hong Kong. So that's kind of a two-parter. It's him and Chow Yun-fat. I had no idea who this man was.
Right.
Or John Woo's films. And then I get a chance to see The Killer, Hard Boiled, A Better Tomorrow, A Better Tomorrow 2. And then obviously I watch City on Fire because it's, there's some parts that obviously Tarantino definitely cherry-picked for Reservoir Dogs. So to see Chow Yun-fat, and even Chow Yun-fat, because of that, started to get popular in America late 90s. He started making movies here.
Sure.
If you remember in 2000, I mean, maybe he would have always got this role, but he's in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. He almost is the original Pai Mei in a way, like films. Because I always, Pai Mei is like the evil version of Chow Yun-fat's character from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Right.
And I just remember thinking that was like the first turn on, like, Asian cinema was not big in America.
No.
And suddenly it was, because of Tarantino saying about these films or about these actors and about John Woo. And you started to hear, because you'd read magazines. There was no like real internet push on this. I would read Empire magazine. I would read Entertainment Weekly. I would read a lot of these films. And every time they would talk to Tarantino and ask him about his, where he got these things, who was referenced, who he liked. And he would always say John Woo, and he would say Chow Yun-fat. And so for me, early on, those were the first two big introductions, was seeing the John Woo films from because you do get to see one, even though it's probably the worst one. A Better Tomorrow 2 is not a great film, but the amazing ending is what Alabama's watching when Clarence goes off to fucking kill Virgil. That's what she's watching when he leaves the house. So, and that's a reference that's in the script, which is amazing that Tony Scott kept it in. Like, it's just amazing that he, trusted the writing enough to leave that reference and actually have it in the movie. But that was an instant, gravitation, because I loved Tarantino, and probably because a lot of the way he did his stylized violence, and to learn that his stylized violence came from somewhere else. You know what I mean? And then that just instantly, I was hooked on him. Instantly,
love
I was hooked on that. Yeah. So Chow Yun-fat, and those two films would be the start.
I didn't even think of this till you started talking, but I'm pretty sure, because I was never a big martial arts Asian filmmaking person growing up as a kid. I'm pretty sure the first time I heard of Jackie Chan was actually from Quentin. I think it was MTV. Was it like he Might gave away been. The yeah. Lifetime Achievement or whatever the hell it was? Because he kept saying Jackie Chan. I do remember that. He was calling him Jackie Chan, which may be correct for all I know. But this is back before even like Rumble in the Bronx came out.
Yeah.
Like, this is early, before Jackie Chan was a household name in America. Mm-hmm. And I remember being turned on to Jackie Chan by Tarantino. Yeah, he was, you're absolutely right, man. So I've got a list here of some things. I don't know where to start. I'll just jump in.
Go right ahead.
A real specific one. George C. Scott.
Yeah.
I'm a big George C. Scott guy. I knew Patton, right? Oscar. But he always just kind of seemed like an older, stodgy guy to me. I assumed a great stage actor or something. I was never totally into him. But then, through Cinema Speculation, mm-hmm. that whole chapter on hardcore, and then through the Video Archives podcast where he talks about the hospital and Rage, and maybe even Hardcore was in that, or I don't think it was in the Video Archives podcast. But anyway, that turned me on to George C. Scott so much so that I've gone back and seen so many of his movies, The Last Run, and I can't even think of all of them. And I've got a lot of memorabilia up on this wall, but I have a picture autographed by George C. Scott, a shot from him on the set of Hardcore. It's him, Paul Schrader, and Susan Hubley, or Hubley, I'm not sure how to pronounce her name, Kurt Russell's first wife there, and they're on the set talking and smoking cigarettes, and it's signed by George C. Scott.
That's awesome.
I never would have been turned on to that had it not been for Tarantino and of course Rolling Thunder, more Paul Schrader stuff. Mm-hmm. It's like, man, but that's like one real specific thing. I'm a George C. Scott fan now because of Quentin Tarantino. So
I only know George C. Scott prior to all of this. Because obviously as a child of the 80s, but he is like the villain in Firestarter.
That's right.
He's the villain in Firestarter.
Yeah.
And so I remember him. I always remember being like, one, he has an amazing presence as an actor. Like his voice and his presence is it's enigmatic. And when you hear him talk, like I was like as a kid, I was like, man, this dude is scary. Like, because he also reminded me of my grandfather, who was also a bit of a scary old school German kind of guy. So you're kind of like, oh, you know, no nonsense type of guy. So George C. Scott reminded me a lot of him. And so then obviously you find out he's Pat. And, you know, as you get older, you learn right. all these things. But for me, George C. Scott, my first introduction always is going to be Firestarter and the Drew Barrymore Firestarter Stephen King film that, you know, that's which right. it's quite a jump because when you first see, you know, learn about Drew Barrymore, it's E.T. and she's Gertie and she's the cute little girl. And then all of a sudden she's yeah. starting fire. And like yep. her dad, I forget what he could do, but he had like everything, his little power, like blood would run out of his nose. And then George C. Scott was like just trying to like capture her and turn her into like this weapon. And you're just like, this little boy, I was kind of like, I don't think I should be watching this movie, but I can't turn away, you know?
Yeah, that's funny. And then when you learn about him too, he's I'm looking something up here on my phone as we talk, but he's such a nut off camera. Like he's apparently serious alcoholic, rageaholic. So he in the 80s was briefly on a TV show. He was the lead in a sitcom, I believe it was a sitcom, although don't quote me, where he played the president. I don't remember the name of the show, but his son on the show is an actor named Andre Gower. And I had Andre Gower on Fanacek about a year awesome. Or so ago. Andre Gower's big thing was he was the lead in, Monster Squad. Like, you know that 80s movie? Yeah. He's the main little boy there, you know. And anyway, so he was on my podcast. He was telling me a story because I was like, hey, you work with George C. Scott. What was that like? He was like, the guy's a fucking prick. But he said that he was a little kid. He got yelled at. Like George C. Scott screamed at him because they were filming a close-up on George C. Scott. So the idea is that Andre Gower is off camera doing lines with him and I guess didn't make eye contact or something. And George C. Scott lit into him. And he was 10 years old, 11 years old. Who the hell knows? But that made me laugh. So I was like, okay. And I've heard some people talk about, like, even for hardcore, he had five like hungover days written into his contract, basically like permission to disappear for about 5 days due to his drinking problem.
Wow.
Yeah
it kind of reminds me of like Lee Marvin had the same kind of thing happen to him when they're doing the Dirty Dozen, and Charles Bronson threatened to kill him because he showed up to set for like the third, fourth or fifth day drunk. Charles Bronson almost killed Lee Marvin. There's
some actor who's only in the movie because I think his job was to basically hang out with Lee Marvin, like to take care of him. You're right. I forget which actor it was, but yeah.
It's amazing the stuff that she's. I mean, it's funny because you say this now, you know, the news out there now is like The Rock is perpetually fucking late and doesn't give a fuck about people. Holds productions up. And that seems kind of mild and tame compared to some of the old days of how things were going on in the movies, you know, basically dragging them into set. I mean, it's really Rick Dalton, right? Like Rick Dalton kind of gives us a glimpse at what some of these Hollywood actors truly were like. They were just booze hounds at night. And then,
but you're a world-class drinker when vendors need to be written into your contract. Yes. Just know there's going to be at least 5 days where I'm missing.
Exactly. That's amazing. All right,
what else you got? You got another one?
So, and this all started from, I wish I could say I was cool enough to be watching blaxploitation films when I was a kid. That's not true. It was Reservoir Dogs in the summer of 93, because obviously, as you know, my journey, I saw True Romance first, bought the VHS, summer of 93, says from the creator of Reservoir Dogs, watch Reservoir Dogs, bing, we're moving on, right? They talk about Pam Grier in the back of this car. Man, she sounds cool. Huh. And then 1997, Pam Grier isn't Jackie Brown. And no one has ever lived up to the hype or the mystique that Pam Grier did. So went on to see Coffee. I mean, last year, you know, I did a whole thing on the films that influenced Jackie Brown. And of course, Foxy Brown and Coffee. I mean, he likes her so much, he's actually created his own coffee name and a coffee bar out of his brand new Vista called Coffee, spelled C-O-F-F-Y, for those who don't know. And it's Pam Grier's beautifully afroed face and head from the movie poster Coffee as the icon. And so she is one of the baddest motherfuckers to walk the planet. And she was so amazing in the movie. The moment I knew she was everything she was sold to us, because obviously when we first see her, she's a downtrodden woman. She's just getting out of prison. Like, her life is fucked, right? So you're kind of like, man. And that's the genius of Tarantino, right? We twist the people we think they are coming into a film. Like, Pacino is this fucking mild-mannered Jewish producer. Marvin Schwartz, you know what I mean? He's not like, give me all you got. You know, he's not losing his mind. Robert De Niro is like a pothead who can barely speak. Like, he changes people against what we as the general public know them. So, you know, you hear this mystique about Pam Grier, and here she is looking just downtrodden. But when Ordell Roby shows up, played by the amazing Samuel Jackson, to try and kill her, and she turns it on him and fucking chews him out and says what she says to him, that was like, wow. Like, you knew that Tarantino had watched every single blaxploitation movie she's ever been in and realized that she had some cool lines, but never got to say something like of real power. Uh-huh. And then she gets to do it and does it to Samuel Jackson at the same time. It's like someone delivering a tough line to Denzel Washington. Like, when you can cut Denzel Washington down, his character down in the scene, you kind of look at that character and go, whoa, okay. You know, so when she did that, I just knew, I was like, this is, and I've been wishing she was in more of his films ever since. I really am kind of shocked that she didn't even find her way into Django in some form, I'm surprised she didn't make Django. But again, that was, 11 years after, 15 years after her movie. So, she was in her 50s, 60s. Maybe just, having her walk around as a slave, maybe there just wasn't a role for her at that time. But I kind of wish we had got more Pam Grier. And she is, my God, she's one of the coolest, baddest motherfuckers ever. And
for the low, low price of $40, man, you can go on the website and buy the coffee cup.
I know you can.
Which I'm likely going to do, by the way.
I'm waiting for the final Mecca trip. I'm going to buy it. Yeah. I'm going to buy it hands on at the store. But
I don't know if I can wait, man.
I know. But it's so cool. I don't even drink coffee really. So,
well, speaking of that world, I wasn't going to bring this up, but you reminded me of it. My wife's grandfather on her mom's side was one of the producers of the Ed Sullivan Show. So because of that, I have lots of cool memorabilia from those days. And I've actually got some of it up on my wall. But going through all of it, I find some stuff. I don't know what it is. So I found this photograph from the set of Ed Sullivan of all these singers and dancers. And I forget the name of the group now. I had to look it up. They had a hit song, some hippy dippy song that's been in a bunch of movies. But one of the it's all white people. There's one black lady in there. So I'm looking at the autograph and it's Teresa Graves. And Teresa Graves was a star of Get Christy Love, which is referenced in Reservoir Dogs. Another cool piece of Tarantino. But I would never have known that. Never jumped out at me had it not been for him,
Between the movies and, if you want to go another one, again, a lot of it is like from his movies. And the funny thing is some of them, I've said this on my podcast, in the first couple of films of his. So in Reservoir Dogs, he talks about Pam Grier.
Yep.
5 years later, she's in Jackie Brown. In True Romance, which he wrote, didn't direct, but in True Romance, we not only talk about Sonny Chiba, we see 3 Sonny Chiba films. The man makes an appearance in the actual film Street Fighter, which I have seen. And then 13 years or 10 years from that movie coming out, Sonny fucking Chiba is Hattori Hanzo on fucking screen. Right. Maybe the greatest side character he's ever created. And then in 1994, Samuel Jackson's character, Jules, he's going to walk off and walk the earth like Kane from Kung Fu. And I knew Kane before Tarantino ever mentioned because I'd seen it on TV. So he's talking about, of course, David Carradine. And sure enough, 10 years later, because we don't see him until 2004.
Right.
But 10 years later, motherfuckers in the fucking film. Like, it's like his first 3 movies that he wrote, he brought these people to life. Like, they went from us knowing them as a pop culture reference to them actually walking across the screen in front of us
in
real life. It was just such a surreal moment for these because, Sonny Chiba, I've seen Street Fighter, and look, it's 1970s film. He's trying to be the Japanese version of kind of Bruce Lee. He's more blunt instrument than he is like, a scalpel, right? He fucks everyone up. Like, Bruce Lee's a little bit more like, kind of ballet. He's just more like Mike Tyson Bruiser. Like, he just punches people, fucks them up for no reason. And so watching that and then seeing him as a Hattori Hanzo, sometimes you look back at the films these people were in and you look and you go, if they always had someone like Tarantino to direct them, imagine what careers they would have had. Right. Because, you know, David Carradine's decent. I mean, look, that's whitewashed Hollywood. I mean, we have a white guy pretending to be a Buddhist monk. Whatever. That's the way things used to be. But you look at him in that show and he's good. He's good. But you look at him as Bill and you're like, that's like a career moment. Same with Pam Grier. I've watched Coffee Fox Brown. She's awesome in it. She's a badass. But she's not as good as she is in Jackie Brown.
Sure.
Jackie Brown, that's Oscar-worthy performance. Yep. And Sonny Chiba's amazing as, obviously, the Street Fighter. It's fun to watch him beat dude's ass. But no one's as mystical or it's just, like, powerful as when he is delivering the sword and the whole thing. Like, he is amazing in Kill Bill. So much so, I'm disappointed he didn't make it to Volume 2 kind of thing. You know what I mean? Like, you're kind of like, dude. And he just had this a way of bringing things to life, these characters that suddenly now are on our screen and now movies we go see of theirs and shows they were in. And I can't think of as a matter of fact, I don't think there is another director out there who has done that. Most people make up names, right? Like there's fake people in their movies. And then maybe you see them down the road. Like Kevin Smith has a lot of people that come in and out of their movies and they have a lot of tongue in cheek moments where, like, I forget the guy's name, but the Jane Silent Bob Save or Jane Silent Bob Strike Back, where like Ben Affleck pretends he's talking about Ben Affleck. You know what I mean? Like he does a little tongue in cheek moment and, like, you know, Ben Affleck was bombing Phantoms. You're like, those are fun moments. I enjoy the tongue in cheek of that. It's really fun. But no one actually talks about somebody and then they're there.
Right.
Right. Like then they suddenly are, not only are they talked about and referenced in real life, but now they're an actor in your film. It's a very meta surreal kind of like mind blowing moment that I think is what makes the fandom so fun for me, is that you hear, but like I said, you hear these three people's names and they're in the movie and they're not just like bit parts. They're not just like, oh, walk across screen. They are like some of the most important characters in those films. Like Pam Grier runs Jackie Brown and she was screwed out of an Oscar. I'm sorry. I'll put her performance against anybody in 97. I still think she's the best performance. I mean, you're telling me a black exploitation actress who hasn't had a real role forever commands a fucking movie. And Meryl Streep can act no matter what. That's not impressive to me. Someone coming out of obscurity and suddenly showing up on set. And obviously Robert Foster as well in that same film.
Yeah, he got an Oscar nomination for it, didn't he?
He got the Golden Globe nomination, but he didn't get the Oscar nomination.
Oh, I thought he got an Oscar nomination. Oh, nope. Shit.
Okay. Not get the Oscar. And then, I mean, David Carradine, we all knew him as, I mean, if you look back in Carradine's career, he was going basically, you know, movie of the week kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, it wasn't good. Anything. Yeah.
He'd done his own, like, after Kung Fu kind of took off, he did his own, like, exercise videos. Yep. You know, not great for David Carradine. But in this film, I mean, if it wasn't for Hans Landa, he may be the best and scariest villain that they had. Hans Landa changed that obviously a couple years later, but up until that point, you're like, man, Bill is a bad motherfucker. Like,
totally, yeah.
He was awesome, you know. But then, I mean, then a guy makes a glass of milk and fucking pastry, fucking terrifying. And then you're like, all right, so he's a little bit better, you know. What I mean? Like he supplants Bill, but that's David Carradine having not been in a major role in probably forever.
What a gift it is too for Quentin Tarantino to do this for some of his heroes, because for we'll use, you know, Pam Grier is a great example. You know, Hollywood wasn't banging down her door. Now I'm sure she could have gotten some roles and some shit.
I think if I look up her IMDb,
we'll see some crappy roles. But this is like, hey, I'm going to give you a platform in a huge film that's going to make a lot of money that a lot of people are going to watch. And you know, it's not like he's not throwing him a bone. No. He's giving the major parts in what he knows is going to be a major movie. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's not fan service. It's not only do I see, I mean, we can pull Travolta into that because I think, you know, we look back in hindsight.
Sure.
Travolta had a great career after that and had a pretty decent career up until that, but he was going nowhere, but he liked Travolta so much and knew he could get it out of him. I mean, he resurrects the man's fucking career.
Yeah. Well, Lawrence Tierney and Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Well, shit.
Probably what another crazy motherfucker. Just in that movie, he was damn near almost got arrested and killed in that movie. I mean, he did get arrested. It's insanity what he did.
There's a book. The reason I was looking up here, there's a book about Lawrence Tierney that I had the author on my show. I mean, so whenever I read a book, if I'm going to have someone on my podcast, an author, I read the book and I take good notes because I want to do a good job. So I'm reading this book about Lawrence Tierney And I'm like, I'm going to start marking down every time he gets arrested. I'm not kidding. I'm 13 pages in. He's been arrested probably 40 times. I stopped. That guy had to have been arrested over 800 times, man. It was just fucking.
He really was Joe Cabot.
Joe Cabot was better.
Joe Cabot said he was out of jail.
Oh, but anyway, not to make it about Lawrence Tierney, but a great example of Tarantino pulling someone in, although, you know, that didn't end well for those guys.
It didn't end well, but sometimes you need some crazy Magny stuff to make the movie work.
Oh, and sure.
I don't think there's a better person to play Joe Cabot than Lawrence Tierney. He's great. Spectacular.
Fucking great.
And then, of course, Chris Penn to play his son is Nice Guy Eddie. I mean, there's nothing Tarantino, that's what I'm saying about him moving on to what he wants to do. He can cast people. I mean, he could tell me he's casting you, and I'm going to go, all right, he's going to be fucking amazing in this film.
Yeah.
Like, I have no doubt. Like, Vaynerchuk's going to get a fucking Oscar. It's just going to happen. Like, well, you know, this is going
to
take off.
It's true. And he's even said it. He's like, people don't say no to me because they know they're going to sound fucking cool in my movie.
Well, also, he started as an actor. So he trained for 6 years as an actor. So he knows how to talk the actor talk and get them to buy into what he's saying and what he wants them to do. And so, I mean, it works. I mean, even Daryl Hannah, not a huge fan of some of her stuff. She was okay. She was just a pretty girl in the 80s. And I don't mean that meanly. I really don't. I don't want people to be like, oh,
what? But you're right. She wasn't great. Like, she's not amazing. I'm just saying, like, Wall Street,
in the 80s, you'll see some women in films that were only there because of their looks, not because they could act. They were just there to be the eye candy for the actor. You know, I mean, or to sell us that some doofy guy could get this hot broad. Like, that's not, you know, that's the way things were. They don't, you know, 90s started to change the language of cinema again. But, like, let's be honest, like, you didn't go to see a horror movie because there wasn't going to be breasts. Like, there was guaranteed to be breasts of some sort if there was a slasher film in the 80s. It's guaranteed. You know what I mean? It was going to happen. Like, if it didn't, then you were on the wrong film.
Yeah.
So, but he has this ability to make these people who sometimes you look like, even Michael Madsen. I've watched his other movies, and I don't want to say he's bad, but they literally just want Michael Madsen. Hey, can you be Mr. Blonde from Reservoir Dogs every film you're in outside of it? I mean, look at Mr. Blonde and then look at Bud.
Yeah.
What a transformation.
Yeah.
What an amazing performance from Michael Madsen. And no one outside of fans give him credit for that. He just, you know, it's kind of like, he was Bud. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That man is going through some shit in that film.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like the
he's pain, my favorite character in
that. Yeah. The pain and anguish he has for what they did in volume one changed his life. He has pulled out of the life and disappeared off the face of the earth.
That woman deserves her revenge.
Yes.
We deserve to die.
But then again,
so does she.
Oh, so good. Like, he's, God damn, he's good.
Yeah.
But, and then, you know, one more guy I'll bring up is who he also has passed. I absolutely love this man, but Michael fucking Parks. And obviously, thankful for him bringing in, we get his son because he's also OB in The Hateful Eight. But Michael Parks as the Texas Ranger. And then, again, I know he does Spanish face or whatever you want to call it. He plays Esteban, but is he not good at Esteban? Like, when he plays Esteban Viejo in Volume 2, he's almost unrecognizable.
Oh, totally.
I don't think he's trying to do a voice or like a blackface type thing. I think he's really trying to bring a real character to life. Because Ricardo Montalban was the guy originally hired for that.
Sure.
I don't see Ricardo Montalban doing that any different.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, I see Ricardo going the same kind of, hey, I'm not just the guy who runs Fantasy Island. I'm a pimp now, and this is my Fantasy Island.
Yeah.
Like, he gets a little bit sleazier with it, just kind of like the subtleties. Yeah.
The cigarette holder
and the reading.
You know, see the waitress's face, like, oh, shit.
Just so much is said in that little performance, you know?
Yeah.
And this is what Tarantino is able to do. And some of these people, like Michael Parks, also went on to star in one of Kevin Smith's movies, two of them actually. But one of my favorite roles of his is a movie called Red State. He plays basically, what's that Kansas City Baptist Church type of people? He plays basically one of those like Bible thumping, almost a Koreshian type characters. You know, they live in like a compound kind of thing. If you haven't seen the movie, it may be Kevin Smith's best movie. It's one of those movies you look at and you go, this doesn't seem like a Kevin Smith movie. But it is spectacular. It's called
Red State. Kevin Smith movie was he in?
He was also in Tusk.
Tusk. Okay.
Yeah.
Was he the old guy?
He's the old guy.
I didn't put that together.
Yeah,
shit.
He's the old guy. Yeah.
I just saw that not too long ago, too, like kind of on the whim. I wasn't. Yeah. Yeah. That movie. I was not prepared for that movie. By
yes.
The way.
No,
I didn't know what it was about.
Again, I think two of Kevin Smith's better movies are these two movies that are just like completely offshoots, you know, like. But Michael Parks is spectacular and he doesn't get cast in those movies, but because of Tarantino bringing
that's
it,
true. That's,
you know,
that's
and he's a great actor. Oh, he's just, you know, when he first pops up at the beginning of From Dusk Till Dawn, I was like, man, I was like, oh, he's dead. But his whole speech, you're like, wow, that's awesome. And then when he showed up at the beginning, we got the sunglass on the dashboard and he pulls up and being a Kill Bill. I was like, I'm so excited. Like, I was so happy. And then he makes a reappearance in Death Proof. I'm like, this is amazing. You know, so Michael Parks is one of those character actors I never would have known. Him and Robert Forster are probably the only two people I never would have known. And again, Robert Forster makes an appearance in my favorite TV show of all time, being Breaking Bad. He's at the end of that series. He's the vacuum cleaner guy who helps get Mr. White out of New Mexico and into the hills of New Hampshire.
Yep.
If you ever see that. And he made his last role a couple months before he died. But it then debuted a couple weeks after he died. But he was in the end of Better Call Saul as well. He gets another appearance in that. So, you know, again, he doesn't get these movies without these things. So, and there's great actors we never would have known if it wasn't for Tarantino.
Well, speaking of people who wouldn't have known, I don't think I would have known Sergio Corbucci.
No, and one of my movies I wrote down, The Great Silence.
Ooh, The Great Silence. I've not seen that one. I got to write that down.
Last year I did a double feature for my Under the Influence. We did for Django Unchained. We looked at Django, and then we looked at The Great Silence. And if you get to watch those, they're made, I think, 2 years apart. I'm not a huge fan of the Django movie. It was a very loose version of For a Few Dollars More.
Sure.
For Fistful of Dollars.
Because there's a bunch of them. You're talking about the one where he's hauling around that damn coffin. And,
Yes. It's a very loose. I mean, basically, in that movie, was a loose interpretation of Yojimbo. So, the Corbucci just didn't want to get sued. What's his name? So, when you watch that film, and I suggest if you can watch it like this, it's okay. It's got its moments, but it's just okay. But when you then watch The Great Silence, which I think is one of the best spaghetti westerns ever made, it is amazing. Klaus Kinski is unbelievable in this film. And the filmmaking, you can see where his moments of Django, the mountain stuff, and then the moments in Hateful Eight come from. It is a beautifully shot film. And Corbucci as a director makes a marked jump in his talent, probably pushed by, obviously, Sergio Leone, but from Django to The Great Silence, it's almost night and day. Like, it is like amazing. It's kind of like Kevin Smith doing like Clerks, and then all of a sudden he's like doing Seven or something. You're like, whoa, what a jump!
Right,
and that really is. But he did it in 2 years, and so Corbucci becomes a much better filmmaker in that 2 year frame. You've never seen anybody. It's like a guy not starting on a team, and all of a sudden he's like the number one guy. You know, whatever sport. It's like Brady sitting on the bench, and then it's Brady. You know what I mean? Like, it was kind of like, who's this fat kid from Michigan? You know what I mean? And now it's like he's a 7-time Super Bowl champion. You know, it's that kind of like. I didn't see that.
And it's just another great example too of Tarantino really just shining a light on somebody, because I became aware, because I love spaghetti westerns, but my knowledge was limited. One of my favorite movies of all time is Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. So I was, Sergio Leone. So I was very well versed in that stuff. When Django came out, I was like, oh, where's this Django Unchained? Mm-hmm. So where's this coming from? So Django is obviously, if people don't know, it's shockingly a lot of people don't know that there's a series of these Django movies, which turned me on to Corbucci. And then of course, Sergio Corbucci is the director of Nebraska Jim.
Nebraska Jim, yes, he is.
You know, and so that's a gift for Corbucci. And then, you know, on the Video Archives podcast, he talked about Sonny and Jed, which I loved. Mm. I went back and watched Sonny and Jed. Great soundtrack, the score rather, fun movie. It's got Telly Savalas in it, you know, and I got an autographed Telly Savalas photo here to go in my collection. So anyway, but again, I wouldn't know Sergio Corbucci. He'd be some long lost stuff collecting dust. And now there's like a generation of people who know the name, you know?
Yeah. And like I said, it's an amazing film. It was one of my favorite films to watch last year, was getting to see The Great Silence.
I got to check it out. The Great Silence. Yeah. Thanks. I'll turn me on to it. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm assuming you've seen Lady Snowblood. I mean, I just go down greats. I mean, I'll tell your listeners, skip Lady Snowblood Part 2. Pointless. Absolute garbage. Disappointing as hell. Stick with just Lady Snowblood. and you will be, I mean, it's a spectacular movie.
Yeah.
So spectacular. And Shogun Assassin, like, they're just, I mean, the list, I have a long list of stuff. I was just like, man, God, that movie.
Yeah, you can go deep. Yeah.
Maybe I would have seen these films. Maybe I wouldn't have. Uh-huh. But because, and how do I not say this without sounding like you are a dick sucker up there, dude. But honestly, I think one of the things, if you are a big fan of Tarantino, I think one of the reasons is, as you said in the beginning of your podcast, he's a steward of film. So he has given us opportunities to see even crap film, like, I mean, even garbage film, but he's at least gotten eyes on films that something about it struck a chord in him and he kept with them. You know, like, if you go back and watch some of the films of our youth that had nostalgia for us, like even The Beastmaster. I love The Beastmaster.
Oh, sure.
Because of its nostalgia. But if you sit down and look at it, it's just a video game where they just keep giving us cooler stuff every other scene that makes no sense why it's there. But you're so enamored with it, like, oh my God, it's the coolest thing I've ever seen. And so sometimes they don't hold up. And I think that's what he does. He just goes, hey, look, this film had something in it that I liked. It was awesome at the time. Especially for the time it's made. And a lot of times, like, you get these amazing films, you know, like what we've talked about, like even old films. On my journey last year, I watched old films because he said they referenced them, like from Kiss Me Deadly and some 40s and 50s films that, like, never would have watched before.
Yeah.
And they were spectacular films. And you go, oh, you see the references. You see the dawn of cinema. Like, I hate when people just go, I only like today's films. Well, that's great. I get it. We've moved in advanced technology. Who knows what's going to happen now with AI? But we don't get here without where we came from. And that, I think, is what Tarantino did for a lot of us who became cinephiles because of him, is we started to look back at stuff we had not put our eyes on because he had either talked about it, referenced it, liked it, said it. I mean, I know people who would listen to his when he was on the Pure Cinema podcast. He came on, I think, sometime in 2020 over over COVID, and he must have rattled off 25 films that I remember knowing buddies who wrote every film down they wanted to go check out, knowing that some of them were going to be garbage, but knowing that somewhere in there was a gem that they had not seen and they now were going to add to their collection, like some of the films I got to see.
Yeah. Well, that's a great segue in what I want to talk about too, because I wrote down, you know, a bunch of things and I want to, and I'm going to get you out of here soon, but
anytime.
But you know, some would say like a George C. Scott or Sergio Corbucci, but one of the things that he really turned me on to is a less tangible thing, but it's I wrote it down. It's permission to just enjoy movies, even if they're not fantastic movies. So, you know, I don't know that I'm a cinephile, but I'm definitely not an average movie watcher either. You know what I mean? But I felt like in my whole adult life and talking about movies, I had to appear to be a cinephile. You see, I had, yes. And then you get cinema speculation. I didn't know what to expect when I got it. I mean, it's Tarantino's. I'm buying it regardless. I got it the fucking day it came out. Boom. And there's an entire chapter on the Funhouse. That movie fucking sucks. And I tried, I worked in a video store growing up as well. So I have that in common with him. So as a teenager, I worked at a mom and pop video store called Videotronics in the Bronx. And I was familiar with the Funhouse, but Tarantino's talking about it, so I'm going to rewatch it. I don't see it what he sees in it, you know, but it was fun. It was fun reading about it. I opened my mind to watch it. He writes about Piranha, that movie I do love. I love her. He writes about or in video archives, he's talking about the Young Nurses, you know, and I used to watch some of those nurse movies, not for the same reasons as him.
I think he was watching for the same reason. He just, on his show, he's a little bit like, well, not much, you know, there's an artistic value to them.
But even like Hardcore or Rolling Thunder, those aren't, you know, fine films. Those are, you know what I mean? Like, but now it's permission to just enjoy them, admit I like them, watch stuff that maybe isn't quote unquote great, and just take little things away from, like I mentioned Sonny and Jed earlier. It's a Sergio Corbucci movie he talked about. It's not a great movie as a whole, but there are certain things in it that I loved. And I'm like, I never would have watched this had he not weirdly given me permission to take 2 hours and watch this. And I've lately decided I'm going to put together my top 10 list of movies of all time, my 10 favorite movies of all time. And it's driving me crazy because I can't do it. But I will say this, it's more fun for me now because I think pre-Tarantino, I would have felt compelled to say the Godfather 2 or whatever the fuck, you know what I mean? and not Young Guns 2, which I really love. I'm a huge Young Guns 2 fan.
Nothing wrong with those, yeah.
But I don't know. So I know that I'm rambling on here, but that's like something that I feel like his being a steward of all these films, not just fine art films, you know what I mean? But just all film has allowed me to do that as well.
I think he's given everyone maybe a chance to look back and be not so snickety on what they think are good films, because not every film is going to be an Oscar film. They're just not. And even some of the Oscar films are, let's be honest, they're boring as fuck.
Oh, awful.
Like sometimes I'm just like, what? Like,
it's all bullshit.
If someone likes My Left Foot or The Painter, you know what? Go with God. If that's what you enjoy, you know what? Enjoy what you enjoy. I'm fine with that. But to me, it's fucking boring.
Sure. Now,
I also know that people aren't going to enjoy The Beastmaster. I don't pretend to think that people are going to be like, that's a fine work of cinema. You know what I mean? Like, I get it. It was fun when I was a kid. I loved it. So I think people hopefully will learn maybe through their own journey. But you go to a movie and just let the movie be the movie, right? Like, just don't, go in with no expectations. I've always been told if you go with no expectations, you'll have no regrets. Because now you can't get worse, right? Like, you have no expectations going to be. And that's what a Tarantino film is. I think we have expectations now, but we don't know what's coming. We have no idea what's going to happen. Your favorite movie was supposed to be a Manson movie. And that motherfucker's on screen for maybe 30 seconds, maybe a minute and a half.
Yeah.
And it's really not even a Manson movie. So we were all led astray, and yet we had a great time in the film.
How do we have a 25-minute sequence at Spahn Ranch, and he's not even there? It's not even there.
Sheeman says Charlie left already? Oh, man. Like, you're like, oh, this is...
Not everybody, everybody, but mostly everybody. Yeah.
That's the genius of it. And, you know, my journey with Bruce Willis. We go into it knowing these are direct-to-DVD movies. Mm-hmm. And we found some ones that are fun that we've enjoyed. And we found some of them that are dog shit. But you can't be surprised they're dog shit. You know where they went to. You know what I mean? Like, so it's that. And just enjoy having fun at watching films. Like, there are some movies he's liked that I'm like, man, this is garbage. And then there's some movies he's liked that I'm like, this is unfucking believable. Like, I just think he sees cinema in a way of, he knows the movie he's getting into. He's not expecting Deer Hunter, Godfather Part II for everything. But again, when people went into the Deer Hunter and Godfather Part II, did they expect the same thing? Did anyone expect Godfather Part II to be maybe the better film than Godfather?
Sure, yeah.
Did anyone think that when, I mean, I know at the time culturally, Star Wars, the first one is, you know, it's like Pulp Fiction. It's like changed what people thought about movies.
The second one's a better film, man.
That's what I'm saying. Did anyone think Empire Strikes Back was going to be the best film in the series, in my opinion?
Yeah, I agree.
No, no one thought that, you know? So you just never know. You just never know what you're going to get. You know, I mean, he did it to us, even though, like I said, it was one film, but when they broke up Kill Bill, Volume 1 is violent as fuck.
Yeah.
Volume 2 is a lot more tense. The stakes are a little bit higher. You know what I mean? We've ratcheted up the tension now. And you didn't see that coming either. Like, you didn't see the bride. I mean, she killed the first two adversaries, lickety-split.
Right.
The only other person she kills in the rest of that movie that we know is Bill. The other two, one was killed by a snake.
Right.
And the other one...
We don't know.
We don't know. You know? So, like...
Yeah.
That's the fun of it, is you didn't know what you're going to get. So, you go into any movie. Anytime I go to film, I like being surprised. I prefer to be surprised by a film. I do have hopes. I have hopes that it's going to be good, but you never know. Some films live up to the hype. Some films don't. But at the end of the day, just know what a film is. You know, like, know the film you're going to. If you're going to King Kong versus Godzilla, don't go in thinking it's going to be the smartest movie you've ever seen made.
Correct.
It's not going to be.
Yeah.
But it could turn out to be like Kong Skull Island, which is amazing. Or like the new Godzilla Minus One, which was an unbelievable film.
Right, right, right.
You could be surprised with some of these films. So just go in and be like, you know what? Going in for, like, what's just recently coming out? The Fall Guy, speaking of your show that you like, you know, a 70s TV show being turned into a movie that's kind of loosely based on it. But I'm going into a thing that's going to be fun. It's got Ryan Gosling. He's playing this weird fucking stunt guy. I'm like, let's go for it. It's going to be a fun stunt movie.
Yeah.
I'm not going in there thinking it's going to be, you know what I mean? Like,
this
is the next Pulp Fiction. That this is Citizen Kane. We're about to change cinema. I'm just going in to have a good time. And I think... I think, you know, people should just enjoy the movies, because at the end of the day, it's just a story.
That's
people it. Telling it's, us the story.
It's a story, and you know, you either you let yourself enjoy it, or maybe you take a few things away from it. I love that shot. I love the way they use music. I love the non-linear storytelling, whatever it is. It doesn't have to, in its totality, be this amazing experience. But I mean, here's what I'm hoping for. Quentin Tarantino's The Beastmaster.
He just, he totally has a mental breakdown. He goes, I'm redoing the Beastmaster. I don't want to hear nothing else. Brad Pitt's the Beastmaster. And you're like, he's a little old. He's a Beastmaster. It'll
be great. I've talked about that movie on my podcast quite a bit. So I didn't, growing up as a little kid, we didn't have cable. We were dirt ass poor. But there's like this 2 week period where we stole cable. My father ran an orange wire across to the backyard. So for like 2 weeks, we had HBO. And then in that 2 weeks, this is the early 80s, mm-hmm. there were two movies that were constantly playing on HBO, at least that I could watch. The Dark Crystal and the fucking Beastmaster.
And they're great movies, too. Both of them are classics.
But was it Mark something?
Mark Singer, I think
Singer,
it is.
That's it. Mark Singer. And the two ferrets, right? Yeah, these like two ferrets.
Yes, two.
And the blonde chick who's then on that 70s show. I can't remember her name.
I said that. So I just covered this on our Cheeky Bastards podcast. We're doing in May. We've discussed. We're doing a nostalgia showdown, and my co-host is discussing Avenging Force, and I'm discussing the Beastmaster. And it was my first pair of titties I got to see on like TV. Like it was that was the first ones I ever saw. And I know I was too young to understand it, but there was something about it. I was like, I don't know. I kind of like those. So yeah. It was just a thing that was. That's it for me. That was it. Tanya Roberts, my first
Tanya Roberts
crush. First crush. She's since passed, which is sad.
Yeah, she's dead. That's right.
She was smoking hot on that 70s show.
Oh yeah, she aged well, man.
Yeah, she was great in that.
And ironically, the first nudity I can remember seeing is Daryl Hannah in Splash.
In Splash.
So
there we go.
There you go, man. But hey, I'm gonna wrap this up, man. I really appreciate you doing this. We got to do this again.
Thank you for having
me
on. Yes, please do.
You know, we could do like a 5 hour version of this, man. I could talk about Tarantino all day long, but I really appreciate you doing this. And where can we find you on social media and all that?
So I finally got my shit together and realized I could change a few things. But you can find me at every place on social media at the Church of QT Pod. I finally got it simpled down to just at Church of QT Pod. And then you can also find me at the Cheeky Bastards Pod for our side quest where we just talk about. The one show is we talk about action movies, and then the other show is the Dropping of Bruce that we also do. So
love it.
Five shows.
That's too much, man.
Hopefully I'm still alive in a year. We're going to simplify. We're going to simplify season four. We're going to cut this down.
And to those of you listening, if you do nothing else, listen to the May 17th episode of The Church and Tarantino featuring yours truly talking about Butch Coolidge.
So, yes, and then you'll be on in July as we talk about Pulp Fiction. We actually get into the icons of Jules and Vincent.
That's right. I'm looking forward to it. Well, sir, thank you for doing this, man. And you and I will talk soon, buddy.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I could talk to that dude all day long. I'll have him on again because, again, we really could have done that for 4, 5, 6 hours, you know. Maybe we'll do an extended cut like Quentin promises to do with that fucking Once Upon a Time in Hollywood that I imagine I'll be waiting the rest of my life for. But if you like the show, you know what to do, folks. Go ahead and rate it, review it, like it. Tell your friends about Old Fanacek. Tell your friends about The Church of Tarantino. And tell them about the Cheeky Bastards and Dropping of Bruce while you're at it. Find me on Facebook. I am Real Fanacek. That's where I spend most of my time. That's where most of you hit me up. But I'm also on X/Twitter. I'm Real Fanacek Pod. Or no, I'm Fanacek Podcast. And you can email me at fanacekpodcast@gmail.com. Still giving away stickers. I just got a new batch of my Fanacek stickers. A lot of you folks seem to like those. So hit me up if you want to be on the podcast or have a request for the podcast. Hit me up and let me know. But what I really need you to do, if I could ask you to do one thing, what would it be? If you were a genie, grant me one wish. Here's what it is. Stay tuned for the next exciting episode of Fanacek.